Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week, we'll hear from Lieutenant General Frank Klotz. He's Undersecretary of Energy for Nuclear Security. And in that role, he leads the National Nuclear Security Administration. He'll be in conversation with Zachary Davis of the Lawrence Livermore National Labs. You may remember that shortly after he came to office, President Obama laid out his vision for reducing the nuclear danger. His speech became known as the Prague Agenda. We're going to get an update on that. This conversation was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Zachary Davis, Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Security Research at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab.
I'm Zachary Davis, and it is my distinct pleasure to be able to introduce Lieutenant General Frank Klotz. He is the Department of Energy's Undersecretary for Nuclear Security, and simultaneously, he's dual-hatted as the Administrator of the National Nuclear Security Administration. Previously, General Klotz has served in a number of important military and national security positions, including Commander of the Air Force Global Strike Command and Director for Nuclear Policy and Arms Control at the National Security Council. Now, for those of you who are not acquainted with the complexity of our U.S. government agency organizations and authorities, General Klotz sits at the crossroads, or the crosshairs, or ground zero, of the entire portfolio of nuclear issues facing our country and the world. His portfolio includes nuclear deterrence, safety and security of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. It includes arms control negotiations. It includes proliferation, nuclear terrorism, and anything to do with nuclear issues. So it's incredibly broad, and it's very difficult to imagine how this can all be managed in the course of a day. I come from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, which is one of the national laboratories under the management and direction and guidance of General Klotz and the NNSA. And so let me ask you with that to welcome General Klotz, who is my boss's 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 boss. So please give him a very warm welcome. General Klotz?
I must say I'm delighted to be here at the San Francisco World Affairs Council. After leaving active duty in the Air Force some 5-6 years ago, and before coming back into government in the Department of Energy 2 years ago, I served as a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in its Washington, D.C. office. And so these types of events are a part of what we did literally every day. And so it sort of feels like being back at home, the opportunity to come here and to talk with you. I also know from that experience that the formal remarks section may, for you, be the least interesting of part of the evening. But I do have some formal remarks, and I will make them very brief, and then we can get to the questions and answers that probably will be of more direct interest to you this evening. But again, it's a delight to be here because the World Affairs Council, especially its focus on the global solutions to the greatest challenges, is very much in line with the message that I'd like to impart this evening. As Zach pointed out, he is in the nuclear security business, and anyone who's familiar with that particular enterprise knows that nuclear threats transcend borders. Likewise, dealing with the problems associated with nuclear threats requires a common ground with both partners and rivals alike. Now, I'd like to start off by jogging your memory and reminding you of two warnings separated by more than 5 decades concerning the threats of nuclear proliferation and of nuclear terrorism. The first came in the 1960 presidential debate when then Senator John F. Kennedy warned, and I'll quote, "Because of new inventions, 10, 15 or 20 nations will have a nuclear capacity, including Red China, by the end of the presidential office in 1964. Now, this prediction obviously did not come to pass in its entirety, in large part because of the global non-proliferation regime that the United States, starting with President Kennedy, helped put in place and has helped lead for more than 60 years. Now, let's fast forward to the year 2005. That year, then-Senator Richard Lugar's had his office survey a group of national security experts, asking them to estimate the likelihood of a nuclear attack, including a terrorist attack, somewhere in the world over the next decade. So that would have been from 2005 to 2015. The response to this question is that 29% of the people asked thought that was likely. And of that 25%, 80% of them, the respondents, felt that such an attack would probably be carried out by terrorists rather than by a state actor. Now, this prediction has not borne out either. And of course, that's not to say it'll never happen, but the progress we've made over the decades in improving nuclear security, particularly over the last decade, have certainly helped reduce the threat. Now, I don't mean to suggest that either of these predictions by then-Senator Kennedy or the respondents to the poll that Senator Lugar commissioned were alarmists. Both reflect the concerns of serious people and, in most cases, backed by sound analysis. I raise these anecdotes simply to underscore that events are not preordained and tragic outcomes can be averted through the application of proper resources, creativity, consistency of purpose, and focus. Now, make no mistake, it's my belief that the nexus of technology on the one hand and violent extremism on the other hand is one of the greatest challenges of our age. And in fact, this was reflected in the 2015 National Security Strategy of the U.S. government, which observed, quite correctly in my view, that no threat poses as grave a danger to our security and well-being as the potential use of nuclear weapons and materials by irresponsible states or terrorists. Now, less than 3 months after his inauguration, President Obama delivered one of the most noteworthy speeches of his presidency in Prague, Czech Republic, where he placed nuclear security at the very center of his policy agenda, where it has remained ever since. In that speech, his vision of achieving a world free from the fear of nuclear weapons received the lion's share of the coverage, along with his pledge to maintain a safe and secure and effective nuclear arsenal as long as nuclear weapons exist. But the president's call for a more robust nuclear security regime, in particular his determination to lock down vulnerable nuclear materials, was no less consequential. Just as important was his urging that the international frameworks be established or strengthened to perform this task and ensure that nuclear material would be properly secured in perpetuity. The president's pledge in that speech to host a global summit on nuclear security laid the foundation for an unprecedented global response to this threat. Now, just this past spring in Washington, D.C., President Obama hosted the fourth such nuclear security summit. He welcomed 55 world leaders to our capital city for the fourth and final nuclear security summit, at least under his direction and leadership. Presidents, prime ministers, foreign ministers from countries large and small represented their nations at this summit, as they have done every 2 years since 2010. Now, as I indicated, the president established the summit process to transform cooperation on nuclear security. Rather than leaving this work to mid-level, mostly bilateral technical exchanges, he sought to establish awareness of nuclear terrorism as a threat, as well as the security responsibilities of those at the various highest levels of government. The image of so many heads of state and heads of government gathering for this purpose could not help but galvanize world attention to the threat of nuclear and radiological terrorism. In particular, the President has used the summits to underscore the universality of this threat. Now, while some states obviously live in more dangerous or conflict-prone regions than others, no country on Earth would be spared the global ramifications of a nuclear or radiological accident or incident. Kofi Annan, as some of you may remember, the former UN Secretary General, made this point quite vividly several years ago. He noted that in addition to causing widespread death and destruction, an act of nuclear terrorism would, and I quote, stagger the world economy and thrust tens of millions of people into dire poverty. His point was, given the relationship between poverty and infant mortality, again, any nuclear terrorist attack would have a second death toll throughout the developing world. So consequently, the foremost goal of the summits that President Obama initiated and inaugurated has been to accelerate the lockdown of nuclear and radiological materials around the world. Now, as Zach pointed out, the organization that I have the honor of leading, the National Nuclear Security Administration within the Department of Energy, has been at the very center of this effort, implementing many of the commitments, both domestic and international, made at these summits. So I'd like to share just a few of NNSA's accomplishments along with some of the challenges that I think we face over the longer term. Since April 2009, NNSA has helped remove or dispose of over 3,800 kilograms of nuclear material from 30 countries. This represents enough material for over 150 nuclear weapons. Over the same period, all highly enriched uranium, or HEU, has been removed from 14 countries plus Taiwan. And in fact, during the most recent nuclear security summit this past spring, the country of Argentina announced that it had removed the last of its highly enriched uranium, thus making South America HEU free. Hundreds of metric tons of Russian HEU have been downblended or permanently eliminated, enough for thousands of nuclear weapons. We've also helped shut down or convert 31 research reactors and isotope production facilities in 18 countries, transitioning from HEU fuel to low-enriched uranium fuel. In addition to helping secure these materials, we've also strengthened our ability to detect and interdict nuclear smuggling. In particular, we've provided radiation detection equipment to 578 international points of entry, and 102 mobile detection systems to 59 different countries. This amounts to over 3,600 radiation portal monitors and nearly 7,700 pieces of handheld equipment. Finally, and just another example of many, NNSA was actively involved in providing the technical analysis that helped inform U.S. policymakers and the U.S. negotiating delegation in the negotiations that led to the successful conclusion last summer of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, also known in the press largely as the Iran deal, a deal signed by several nations, including Iran, which blocks Iran's pathways to fielding a nuclear weapon. And NSA will continue to support the work of the U.S. government in helping implement this accord, such as the redesign of Iran's Arak reactor so that it can not be used to produce weapons-grade plutonium. We've also continued to provide, as we have for decades, training, technology, and expertise to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, which, as many of you know, has a crucial role in verifying Iran's compliance with the nuclear provisions of the JCPOA. Now, in the interest of time, I can't do justice to the breadth and range of our activities to improve nuclear security, but these accomplishments should give you confidence that this mission is among the very highest priorities of NNSA, of the Department of Energy and indeed of the entire U.S. government. Now, just as the nuclear security mission did not begin with the first summit, it will not end now that the summits under President Obama's leadership have concluded. There are some constants that we will have to continue to grapple with for the foreseeable future, if not permanently. The first of these is managing the legacy of the Cold War, particularly securing and eliminating excess weapons-grade material. This will, in my view, be a multi-generational challenge. Even if the cost of obtaining nuclear weapons outweigh the benefits, some governments and some terrorists may aspire now or in the future to obtain a nuclear weapons capability. And indeed, the visceral fear of all things nuclear may, in many quarters, mean that nuclear and radiological devices will be attractive to some terrorist groups. For this reason, keeping nuclear and radiological material beyond the reach of non-state actors is a requirement that simply will never go away. Finally, in addition to addressing current threats, we also have to anticipate future dangers that have not yet taken shape. This is especially true where technology is concerned, as advances, for example, advanced manufacturing techniques like additive manufacturing, could present new ways for terrorists and irresponsible states to acquire nuclear capabilities. Expanding global trade volumes, coupled with growing sophistication of illicit procurement networks, will make it more difficult to deny access to such dual-use technology. Each of these developments may disrupt traditional approaches to nuclear security. As a result, we're actively exploring means to mitigate these threats while at the same time taking advantage of the technological advancement for our economy and for our national security needs. So let me say, Zach, in conclusion, that nuclear security has been central to President Obama's national security strategy, and in my view will be an extremely important part of his legacy. Having identified nuclear terrorism and nuclear proliferation as two of the greatest threats to our security and welfare, the President has brought the full weight of his office and our government to defend against them. This effort was not just about preventing deaths at the hands of extremists, although the scale of such a tragedy would be unspeakable. The implications here are much broader. Without nuclear security and an international nonproliferation regime, the future of nuclear energy itself is threatened, and with it, our ability to reduce dependence on fossil fuels and to combat climate change. This is a mission that has implications for all the world, and no solution will be found without global cooperation. So thank you again for allowing me to make a few opening remarks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that Zach, you may have, or our participants in this roundtable may have.
Thank you. Thank you so much, General Klotz. Let me open up the discussion by admitting that I was one of those experts who gave the when Senator Lugar asked us to show up by a show of hands, you know, who thinks that this is going to happen, and I was quick to. So I had that grim outlook, and it was a view that was held by many, and yet here we are. It has not happened. The worst has not happened, and so the things that really evoke, you know, some of the most concerns really have not happened. If we were to take that poll again, do you think that we would get the same result, or would you say that maybe the threat has changed in the years, and would that be because we've been successful in our efforts to, you know, to control these dangers, or would that be just dumb luck or something else?
Well, no, that's an extraordinarily good question, and what a coincidence to know that you were part of that that poll. We didn't know that when we when we did that research. Let me say that I think one of the things that has changed, and largely by the very inspirational work of Senator Lugar, Senator Nunn, and others, that bears a lot of the responsibility for the situation which we find ourselves in. Some of you may know that at the end of the Cold War, as the Soviet Union collapsed, there was great concern about the security of former Soviet nuclear weapons and security associated with the Soviet nuclear enterprise. And largely at the leadership of Senator Lugar and Senator Nunn, a program called Cooperative Threat Reduction was established, which used U.S. funds to carry out projects in the former Soviet Union to enhance the security of both military and civil nuclear facilities, to improve transportation of nuclear materials, make them more safe, and to reduce dangers from other weapons of mass destruction, such as chemical weapons and biological weapons. In my view, I've said this before publicly, I'll say it again, I think Senator Nunn and Senator Lugar deserve the Nobel Peace Prize for the work that they did, and they have received appropriate recognition from the United States and other countries for the work that they did. So that was an important part of it, but there's a whole host of other things as we have built as a nation and as a partner in the larger international effort, a regime, a network of various treaties, conventions, agreements that deal with various aspects of the total issue. Obviously, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Limited Test Ban Treaty, Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, and the Threshold Nuclear Test Ban Treaty have played a major role, but also such things as the Convention on the Physical Protection of Nuclear Materials, which has been endorsed by a number of countries. And in fact, there was an amendment passed several years ago that required nations to adopt national laws for the physical protection of nuclear materials. The United States ratified that, and in fact, there have been enough ratifications from other countries that the amendment has now gone into effect. So this whole network, this interlocking web of agreements has done an awful lot to, as I said, lock down nuclear material, enhance security in those nations which have radiological materials.
The efforts that we have made towards helping Russia and the former Soviet states to really get full control of their nuclear assets have really damped down and perhaps really stopped any further leakage of those materials into the potential interested parties who would perhaps want to get a hold of stray nuclear weapons or materials?
Well, I think it has helped enormously, and it was very, very important to work on these issues. But as I think I may have indicated in my opening remarks, nuclear security is not a destination. It's a journey. The number of countries which are interested, for instance, in civil nuclear programs as a source of energy, and more importantly, a source of clean energy, is broadening across the country, across the world. So there is a number of countries which are at a very early stage in developing domestic legislation and best practices to, in fact, secure materials associated with civil nuclear power. So this is something I think that we're going to have to be, as I hope I indicated, we're going to have to be working on for decades to come, as long as there are nuclear and radiological materials out there.
With the relations between the United States and Russia taking a turn for the worse, what is the outlook for those kinds of cooperative programs, and is there more that needs to be done, and is there a way to get past the current difficulties?
That's a very good question, and in fact, the opportunities and the scope for cooperation on enhancing security within the borders of Russia have been sharply circumscribed in the past several years. Part of this was a desire on the part of the Russians to no longer be, in their view, in a donor-recipient relationship with the United States when it came to funding upgrades to their nuclear and radiological security. And then part of it also has to do with the fact that the bilateral relationship between the United States and Russia has certainly been troubled over the last several years with events such as the invasion of Crimea, the illegal annexation of Crimea, the fomenting of violence in the eastern Ukraine, the violation of the nuclear forces, the INF treaty. All of these have affected our overall bilateral relationship, including our relationship in terms of nuclear security. Now, having said that, the Russians continue, in my view, to be very helpful and very cooperative in efforts that we undertake together, working with other countries, third-party countries, in terms of helping them secure nuclear and radiological materials in their country. For instance, later this year, we will conclude a project that the NNSA has had a large role in removing the last of the HEU from a Chinese-designed nuclear reactor in an African country. And the Russians are playing a very, very significant and constructive role in that process of repatriating or removing that fuel to a more secure place for storage and converting the reactor. So I think we'll need to look for opportunities where we can continue on the international scale or international level for their experts and our experts to work with other countries to reduce the threats.
Here's a question for you about the monitoring and inspection of nuclear smuggling, cross-border sites, ports. Now that is an area that is belongs to the NNSA.
Yes.
And something that, so could you maybe give us a little insight into how these programs operate to keep us safe from nuclear smuggling?
One of the major research and development efforts we help support is developing the various tools necessary to detect nuclear material that may be in a container that someone is trying to use to ship across the border. A couple days ago, I was at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in Berkeley, California, just adjacent to, well, actually part of the University of California Berkeley campus, and got a chance to see the work that they're doing in designing new crystals that are put into the various detection devices that will, pardon me for getting technical here, that will scintillate if radiation passes through the crystal and send an electrical signal to a detector that will indicate that nuclear radiological material was there, to research using lasers to perhaps detect, identify, and characterize nuclear material from a distance, quite a distance, as it turns out. We help fund and promote that kind of research and development at several of our laboratories. We have also helped through purchasing equipment and then installing that equipment and then training people to use that equipment in a number of different countries across the world, including helping the countries decide where on their borders, where on their ports they should site various either fixed monitors or portable monitors to detect smuggling along likely routes. This is something basically which we will provide this equipment, and then we will work to get out of the business of supporting that country by training the trainer and developing a local domestic capability to maintain that equipment over time. This is a hugely important effort. It is an effort sometimes in which there is countervailing pressures within the government to fund, but I think it is extraordinarily important work, and it's something that the United States, because of its particular expertise in our laboratories for pushing the technology to the next level, has a both a moral and a practical imperative to carry out.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Lieutenant General Frank Klotz. He's the Undersecretary of Energy for Nuclear Security, and in that role, he leads the National Nuclear Security Administration. He's in conversation with Zachary Davis. He's with the Center for Global Security Research at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. Let's go back to our conversation.
Several folks want to know if a nuclear renaissance that would expand nuclear energy production around the world for the purpose of limiting climate change would carry with it some potential nuclear dangers, in that additional nuclear material and nuclear transportation and might have some risk associated with it.
It is the position of this administration, it's the position of the Department of Energy and of NNSA, that we need to pursue an all-of-the-above strategy with respect to energy, placing a particular emphasis on clean energy. And a lot of what the Department of Energy does, not so much the NNSA, but the Department of Energy does, is to promote, fund, create the opportunity, advocate for a whole range of research and development of alternative clean energy sources. And nuclear is one of those. But like most things in life, everything that, that we pursue has some risk, and that's one of the reasons why we in the NNSA are very cognizant of the fact that there are a number of nations across the international sphere that are interested now or perhaps in the future in pursuing civil nuclear power as a means of meeting future energy requirements and combating climate change. And so that's why we devote the attention that we do to it. But you have to ask yourself, you know, the risks of not doing it and the benefits of pursuing nuclear power may be compelling in this instance.
Yeah. So a number of folks have questions about nuclear deterrence mm-hmm. and the state of deterrence today, whether it be the status of the U.S. nuclear deterrent posture and capability or the deterrent conditions that are developing in the regional context, that is, you know, what is North Korea up to, and are we going to have deterrence with North Korea? Is deterrence in South Asia between India and Pakistan a stable condition that is likely to have the same sort of benefits as it did during the Cold War in preventing all-out wars between the United States and Soviet Union? Is deterrence still a concept that applies in the world today?
At least as far as the United States is concerned, nuclear deterrence is still part of our overall national security strategy. The national security strategy was, as I pointed out, just most recently rearticulated in 2015 and is available on the web for anyone who wants to read it. And as the president said in his Prague speech in 2009, that as long as nuclear weapons exist, we must maintain a safe, secure, and effective nuclear arsenal. Now, let me say a little bit about that nuclear arsenal. It is a very different nuclear arsenal than we had in the Cold War. We, at one point in this country, had over 31,000 nuclear weapons. We reached that peak number in 1967. Since then, the size of our nuclear arsenal has been decreasing quite dramatically as a result of nuclear arms control agreements with the Soviet Union and now Russia, most recently with the New START Treaty, which was negotiated and ratified under President Obama's leadership and with the consent of the Senate. It has also been dramatically reduced as a result of the end of the Cold War, so that now we are you know, have our active stockpile is in around the 4,500, slightly less number. We started making that number publicly available several years ago, and usually in the fall we come out with a new number. Another thing about the current U.S. nuclear arsenal, it is now the smallest and the smallest arsenal we've had since the early Eisenhower administration. It's also the oldest stockpile that we've ever had. The policy of the United States, of the U.S. administration now, is not to develop new nuclear weapons. So what we have been doing is extending the life of those nuclear weapons which remain in this smaller stockpile. And that is one of the principal responsibilities of the nuclear, National Nuclear Security Administration. It's one of the principal responsibilities of our national laboratories for which we have responsibility for. And so that's a large part of the effort. Right now we are carrying out three life extension programs, one major alteration to ensure that the weapons that remain, in some cases designed for much shorter service lives, will be extended for as long as they need to be in the arsenal. Other nations obviously think that nuclear deterrence is an important part of their overall national security strategy. Whether it's the United Kingdom, France, Russia, China, they have both publicly indicated that this is an important part of their overall defense strategy. All those countries are taking steps to modernize, replace, extend the life of the systems that they have now. You mentioned India and Pakistan. Also have stated that deterrence, variously defined as minimum deterrence or full spectrum deterrence, is an important part of their national security strategy as well. But deterrence as a concept doesn't fit various countries or various regions in the exact same way. I've had before I came back into government, involved in a number of Track 2 discussions with, like you have been, with nuclear experts from various countries. And they will tell you that while the history of deterrence that characterized U.S.-Soviet relations during the Cold War is important history, it may not be fully applicable to a given region, a given with its own geographic, historical, cultural, political dynamic. So we have to look at deterrence as a theory as it pertains to particular regions and the dynamic among both bilateral and multilateral of the nations in that region.
So what would you see as the future for arms control? Is there a future for the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty? Is there a future for follow-on treaties such as the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, which has been sort of stuck for the last few years? I mean, after the summits and after New START, is there a future for arms control?
Well, I certainly hope that there is a future for the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. As you may know, the United States has been, the other nuclear capable nations have been following a voluntary moratorium on conducting explosive nuclear tests. We followed that since 1992. That was our last explosive nuclear test. We were also took a lead in negotiating the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, following on, as I indicated earlier, the work on the Limited Test Ban Treaty and the threshold test ban treaties which had taken place in previous administrations. And in fact, when the treaty was opened for signature in the Clinton administration, the United States, President Bill Clinton, was actually the first person to sign Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, known as the CTBT. However, in our political system, the president or his representative, such as Secretary of State, can sign a treaty, but the Senate must consent to its ratification, and they do that through a resolution of consent to ratification. The founders of the American Republic set a pretty high bar. It requires a two-thirds vote by the Senate. That's more than a supermajority. That's 67 votes and a pretty high bar. The treaty in the last waning months of the Clinton administration was brought up for debate within the Senate, and it did not achieve the 67 vote margin it needed. In fact, a majority of senators voted against consent to resolution of ratification. They had two concerns in the 1990s. The first concern was, could you effectively monitor the health and safety of America's nuclear weapons stockpile without explosive nuclear testing? And I must say at the time that probably was a legitimate concern. But one of the things that we have been pursuing, and the Department of Energy and NNSA have been at the forefront of this, is developing the experimental tools and the diagnostic capabilities and the high performance computing capabilities to be able to annually certify that the stockpile remains safe, secure, and effective without underground or explosive nuclear testing. In the mid-1990s, you could have doubted, as many skeptics did, whether we would have the technical wherewithal to do that, or if the nation would be willing to invest over a number of years the resources necessary to develop those capabilities. Well, we did, we have, and we continue to refine those, and places like where you work at Lawrence Livermore are a key part of that. So that table, or that a reason for not supporting the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, I think, should be taken off the table. The second objection that was raised in the 1990s was that would we be able to, we the United States and other countries, be able to effectively verify that all nations were abiding by the provisions of the treaty and were not covertly testing, clandestinely testing nuclear weapons. And again, in the mid-1990s, you might have had reason to be concerned. But since then, an organization known as the CTBT Preparatory Organization has been developing and fielding stations that are part of the international monitoring system for detecting possible nuclear explosions. They use a variety of instruments that measure different phenomena, such as seismic waves, radionuclides that would be the product of a nuclear test or explosion, infrasound detection, a whole range of technical phenomenology. And again, in the mid-1990s, that was just an idea and a concept. Now, the vast majority of the stations are actually out there and working. In addition to that, the United States has continued to develop its own national means of trying to detect whether people are testing nuclear weapons. So on both grounds, that can also now be taken off the table as an objection. So I think it's very, very important that we now begin the process of, again, educating the American public, the international community, our own decision makers within government of the merits of this treaty. And when the time is right, politically, that we press forward with that.
And maybe a word about the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, the rationale for a global treaty that would end the further production of the weapons usable materials?
Well, I mean, the concept there is, in order to have a nuclear weapon, you have to have certain key ingredients. One of them is highly enriched uranium, and the other is weapons-grade plutonium. And known in the category of fissile material. So one of the ways you could get at preventing proliferation and keeping down the overall stocks of fissile material that might be attractive to terrorists or non-state actors is to reduce the production of those materials. And as I indicated, we have been working very closely bilaterally and internationally with other countries to reduce the stocks of those and to find alternative ways to achieve particular you know, the particular reasons why you might use highly enriched uranium. For instance, highly enriched uranium is used by a number of countries as targets for the production of isotopes, which are of particular elements, which are used in a wide variety of applications, medical applications, construction, other industrial purposes. So we have been supporting research and development, again, at our laboratories and with commercial entities to come up with alternatives to highly enriched uranium, such as low enriched uranium, which cannot be used in a nuclear weapon.
You talked about some of the amazing new technologies are coming out of the labs and also out of Silicon Valley, and new technology emerging, you know, faster than anyone can really keep track of, and probably faster than has ever occurred throughout human history. Mm-hmm. And so, for all of the wonderful things that are coming as a result of this technology revolution, and all of the great benefits to mankind that come along with it. You mentioned, for example, additive manufacturing and the potential for some of these technologies to take a direction of becoming emerging and disruptive technologies that may, in some ways, you know, create new threats to national and international security. Could you talk a little bit about that and how that may be changing the landscape?
Okay, well, first of all, I think at this stage there is no reason to be alarmed about this, but I think there's reason to, with every new technology, to think very, very seriously about the unanticipated or unintended consequences or ways in which that technology might be used in military applications, and including applications related to nuclear weapons. You know, historically, the development of a nuclear weapons capability has required a fairly advanced, sophisticated state of industrial development and scientific and engineering sophistication, including the ability to produce particular types of materials, to machine those materials, and so on. The concern, and it is a concern, about things like additive manufacturing, is there a way in which you could use systems which can prototype and develop various materials and componentry very, very quickly and very, very cheaply be used as a shortcut to that same kind of technological sophistication which has been characteristic of nations which are pursuing nuclear weapons. So again, I don't think there is a cause for alarm. There is a tremendous amount of potential both in the national security realm, but also in commercial, medical, industrial applications of things like additive manufacturing. But I think it's useful for those of us who have a responsibility and know a little bit about, you know, how these things might be used, to think very, very seriously about it and to consider all the potential consequences. And we're doing that. We have set up with our laboratories groups to think about these issues and to consider them, just as we do as a country and as parts of alliances and international regimes for exports of all types of material. You may know that there's an organization known as the Nuclear Suppliers Group, which has basically helps monitor two particular types of list. One, which is technology directly related to nuclear weapons and potential proliferation risk, but another list called the dual export list, which they carefully monitor to ensure that, you know, technology which might be part of the larger enterprise to develop a nuclear capability is closely watched when decisions are made whether to export that to a particular country, and to ensure that the proper safeguards are in place if indeed such exports go forward.
All right, thank you. We are really actually making our way through, so one last bundle of questions have to do with cyber threats and whether, in general, the cyber threats could potentially endanger the safety, security of nuclear materials or nuclear weapons. Is that something that you worry about, or is that overhyped?
No, it's one of those technological developments, which again we need to think through the the practical implications of that. As far as U.S. Nuclear arsenal is concerned, this is an issue which we have very carefully thought about for decades, and I feel quite confident that our nuclear enterprise is safe. What is perhaps more concerning is, again, as I indicated earlier, as in the civil nuclear realm, where there are large amounts of spent fuel being stored or being used in reactors or being processed, and in some cases the processes for doing that safely and securely rely upon automated capabilities. We have to think in terms of whether or not those particular mechanisms are safe from cyber threat, because as we all know in reading the newspapers, anybody who is hooked up to the web, whether at home or in a bank or in a major commercial operation, is potentially vulnerable to cyber threats. So it's a worrying concern, and it's one which as we move further and further into the digital age, is going to occupy more and more of our time and attention.
All right, thank you. So as we draw to a close here, and I know we've taken a lot of your time, and I saved this one for last because it may provide an opportunity to tie all this together. So the question is, of all of these threats, all of these concerns, which one keeps you up at night?
It's going to be an answer you're not going to expect. And let me tell you what gives me the most cause for concern. In order to carry out this very, very important work that we do, we need, I think, essentially two things. First of all, we need a very highly trained, highly motivated workforce of scientists, engineers, technicians to do this work. As everyone knows, there is a high demand, well, there's a low output and a high demand for students graduating from high school or undergraduate programs or graduate programs in the STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And as an enterprise which relies very heavily on that kind of expertise, we find ourselves in competition with many companies, many of which are located in this area. Many of which are located in this area. Now, I'm excited and delighted that, you know, the United States is an engine of innovation in the high-tech fields, but they also are, those companies are a competitor for the same talent that we need. So I worry about whether or not we're going to be able to recruit and, more importantly, retain enough people with these skills to continue to do this very, very important work for the long term. If you take a look at the demographics of the nuclear enterprise right now, we are truly, we truly see a bathtub with sort of the, you know, the late 30s to late 40s very underrepresented. And we have a large number of people who are of my generation and are now retirement eligible. Now, many of them will stay because they like the work they do, they feel it's important, or they have personal reasons why they need to continue to earn a salary, but they have the potential to leave at any time, and therefore we need to make sure that the replacements are there. That's the first thing I worry about. The second thing is the infrastructure in which we, the facilities, the buildings, the production facilities, in which where we do this work is aging. Some of the facilities that we have, including out here at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, literally date back to the Second World War. So it makes it, you know, just maintaining those buildings, ensuring that the people who work in those buildings are safe from structural failure or have a quality workforce so that we can, a quality work environment so that we can continue to retain them is a major concern of mine. And the costs of replacing those facilities, or as we call it, recapitalizing those facilities, is phenomenal because we are, after all, in the nuclear business. We're not building an automotive factory, we're not building some other industrial concern, we're dealing, we're in some cases building production facilities that have to handle some very special materials and have to be handled in very special ways. So it's an extraordinary cost that we're facing at the very same time that there are some very real caps placed on the that part of the U.S. Budget that can be devoted to these kinds of things. So those are actually the two things that, in the position that I am right now, that I worry a lot about.
Well, thank you very much for your time and your insights and for your answers to all of our questions. Let's thank General Klotz for his...
Thanks.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program featured Lieutenant General Frank Klotz. He is Undersecretary of Energy for Nuclear Security, and in that role, he leads the National Nuclear Security Administration. He was in conversation with Zachary Davis of the Center for Global Security Research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. If you'd like to take part in future conversations at the World Affairs Council or hear podcasts of any of our events, visit us at worldaffairs.org. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jane Heaven. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.